Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate that, bro.
Welcome
to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Oh, we're going to get into it today. And you know what? I reached out this week to a very, very, you know, there's not a lot of people that I worked with over my 25 years that I would say to this day are my friends. And you guys are tuning into the show. Ladies, welcome. Waco, what's going on? Facebook, what's going on? Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, ATL. Not a lot of people that I consider a friend. And I don't mean a Facebook friend. I mean a ride or die, hence the title. Somebody who never said I'll ride with you, but let me take my own car because it might get bumpy and I want to be able to get off. And the other day, we were just talking, and this brother's going to come on and talk to you guys about a program that he did. Nobody told him to do it. He wasn't mandated to do it. And he's going to talk about something that he did. And I've known this guy. He's real special to me. I don't say that about a lot of people, but he's special to me because he and I, hello, Waco, somebody, y'all hear me when I say this. Parkside Villages, Sherman Manor, Trinwood, Estella Maxey, Kate Ross, South Terrace. All right? I'm not talking about yesterday or last week. I'm talking about the 90s when Waco was number one in the nation per capita for violent crime, where folks would shoot somebody in front of a police officer and did not care. Where people laying out on the street dead could be as commonplace as an abandoned vehicle. That's real talk. I lived in one of these communities, Brook Oaks. What's going on, Brook Oaks? I lived there, and I loved the community. And that's where Parkside Villages were. That's where John and I mostly worked, there in East Waco together. And I've had a lot of good partners over the years. I had some I could tolerate, some probably who could tolerate me, some probably who didn't like me, and vice versa. But when John and I got out of the car, salt and pepper, day and night, but when we dealt with these people straight up, it was 100. And I'm gonna dispel a myth right now of, you know, that's that white officer. I never heard anybody, and we've had some gangsters call this show, come on this show, that would never call here today and say, white. White was never even mentioned in his description, ever. He had a nickname. I let him, when I introduce him, and when I let him get into his story. But today, even with my dealings with the city of Waco and the lawsuit, all that, that's not going to be talked about on the show. We're not going to badmouth Waco PD. I'm not here to badmouth the city. All that's over there. I got somebody handling that. But when he told me he would, that really meant, John, you didn't even know this. But when I asked you if you would come on and talk about your program and you said you would, that meant a lot to me. Because I spent my last year and a half in isolation down there. But never with you and a few other people. Now, you worked days, and I worked midnights. I would see you in passing. And Stan, come here for a minute. You okay? How's everything? How's your family? How's this? How's that? Brother, you meant a lot to me. And the fact that you come on here, and you didn't wait. If I'd have called you when you were working, I know you were. Because that's just what you're made of.
Right.
So, brother, I appreciate you being here. Let me get to the co-host, and then we're gonna go straight in with you, brother, to lead this off. Because I really didn't draw this connection until I just started talking. When I talk about ride or die, and I really looked at it from the aspect of the show topic of police reform, but our personal relationship, ride or die is you and how you've always been with me. But we're going to get to the co-host and say what's up. And we got to go down And if I don't do this, this man gonna say something, even though he talked over it the first time, so everybody knows who he is.
He's the triple threat from Los Angeles, California. The timeless talkative titan that tackles the tough topics that take time to think through. Tactfully telling the truth today. It's Reverend Tony Tillman.
Oh, my God. That is, thank you, Shane. I didn't know you put that together for me.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. I got the love for you, okay? You represent the cross, and I thank you for that. So, Lord, bless Sam today in the name of Jesus. Bless all of our co-hosts. And, Lord, be patient with your healings. Everything is going good out here in L.A., so just glad to be here. I won't take up much of your time. I want us to just be prayerful for our ladies. We'll be back next year. Look at our daughters, and thank God for the rain. So, there's a ram and a
deacon,
and we doing just fine. I love y'all. All about Jesus.
All right, Reverend T. Man, that was quick. Appreciate that. And I know y'all looking at the background, be like, what the hell is wrong with him? That was most appropriate. Let me go over Big John. What's up, bro? And John, we got to give a shout-out to somebody very special. You and I talked. You've been on pins and needles with John. Now, let me get to John Ruffin, then I'm going to get to John A. I gotta get that right. I got two Johns today. Yeah. All right. Big John, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? First of all, I want to say that Reverend Tone has to save some of his energy. He has to do the eulogy for the Lakers.
Oh, that's cool.
So we appreciate you being short-winded, brother. Yes, man, it's special, bro. It's real special today. And I want to share this with you, Joe, and everyone else, right? So for the listeners who are calling for the first time, I've done 24 and a half straight years in prison. And I want to send a message out to all you guys who are still in the streets and you have a second chance or first chance. Get out of the streets, bro, because you miss a lot. In 24 and a half years, I missed every prom, every father and daughter dance. I missed a lot. My child wasn't able to say, what your father do for a living? You know, she wasn't able to say, he's a fireman, he's a police officer. I was a criminal. And that's not anything any child was proud of. I don't care how many pairs of Jordans you buy for your kids. But the name of the show is Ride or Die. Before you can ride from the streets, you have to ride from your family. And I want to say that to you guys, man. Wake up, man, because I'm blessed and fortunate today because I missed everything with all my children, but I'm fortunate today that I have a granddaughter who's going to her senior prom, and grandpa is invited to be there to send her off. So I'm looking forward to that, man, and it's a real highlight. And I think a lot of people take for granted, you know, what they have. And it's nothing like family. And for me, it's a huge blessing to make it home. Because I left a lot of guys who would never see their grandkids graduate or any of those things. And before any of you guys find yourself in new circumstances, get out of the streets, bro. It ain't worth it. You can't make up for the stuff that you missed. But I can see in my daughter's eyes that she's really happy. And I'm home for her daughter's senior prom, and I'm looking forward to being the grandpa to say, man, I have my baby home at 9:30.
Or you're going to make phone calls. If we can travel, we got cars.
I got detectives on the case, so, you know, I got friends in high places.
And for those that are tuning in for the first time, you know, the co-host that you see, and Big John is a co-host. He's not a commentator. Because our show is built around an expert in everything society needs to know about. And when these brothers come on here and they share their personal lives and their personal feelings, and, you know, don't you guys listening, this is not sound bites. We're not built on likes and clicks here. You know, we don't ask anybody, there's no GoFundMe, there's no donate page for this show. We do this. Every Saturday, the next man I'm going to go to has kids. He takes time away from every Saturday. And some of y'all will go, well, I do that too. And This man is responsible for an entire city and involved in that city. There's a difference between being responsible for a city, I've seen that part, and involved in your city. This is the only chief of police in this country that has enough balls to be here every Saturday and say how he feels, what he feels. We're honored to have. This is the chief of our shop. And Chief Devlin, wait a minute. First, how is Miss Chief?
I think school year is over. She's on summer vacation. She couldn't be in town. So that makes my life one of the fantastic as well, because my wife is happy. So I just want to say good morning to everybody. Looking forward to getting into the show. Good to see you. John, we can call him John A.
No, he's going to be John, and John Rufford is Big John.
Well, good to see John A. That will be retired here on the show from Air Face, and actually lives in my community. But hey, ready to get on topic, and Tony, you got to get another hat. That is just the truth.
And Chief, you didn't know I was going to do this, but you posted something that meant a lot to you. Number one, for you to post it, it meant a lot to you, I know. And it meant a lot to me when I read it about the young lady.
Yeah.
And, you know, we, like I said, we do this. If we get to the topic, we get to the topic. We, on here, I don't care about anybody's personal religious feelings. We tend to go where God takes this show. And my language may not always be godly, but the situation I talk about isn't either. So it is what it is. But, Chief, if you would, take some time and talk about that post, please.
Yeah, so, yesterday, it actually was, come to find out, like 5 years in the making that this started. There was one of the officers from Waco ISD had reached out to a young lady. Her name was Rosalyn. And her family, she started a Hug for Love tour. And these folks are from Louisiana. You can look them up on Facebook. Trying to find their little handle there, so I was just looking at them. But Rosalyn and her family basically are traveling across the United States in support of law enforcement, and just, her mission is to hug every officer she can find in all 50 states. This is a 10-year-old girl, folks. She has more wisdom than I've seen in a very long time. This is just this is a kid that cares about humanity. I think people should probably go look at her page, go check her website out, pay attention to what she's doing. She's connecting citizens and officers one hug at a time. Her little brother, Philip, who's, I think he's about six, he's hanging out quite a bit. We're chilling, and he's down a cupcake, yeah, blew all over his face. Right after she hugged you, he was right there. You know, so this is a family thing. So her mother got up there and got to speak and talk about she's just trying to allow her daughter to fulfill her mission. She believes it's God's purpose that this is what she's supposed to do to go out and connect this community, get connected to the nation. I don't want to say community. But this thing took 5 years for her to get here. I think the Waco ISD officer had reached out. It just didn't work. She's been, I think she's got 15 states left to visit. And she started this many, many years ago. But it's a Hug for Love on Facebook. And she's got rockthisrosalindlove.com. Or hugforlove.com. I'm just trying to make sure I got the right one. Hugforlove.com on that's her website. But, I mean, it was a really cool deal. I got invited by actually my wife, PD. They put up a call and said, hey, if you guys want to come out and set a representative. We had a lot of agencies from McLennan County show up. And you know, it was a really good day. It's one of those things that, that you're a cop, it's one of those moments that you'll carry with you for the rest of your career. I mean, simply, and it was just a hug. And to listen to Mom, talk to her, I got a chance to talk to her. It wasn't about black or white. It wasn't about police and citizens. It was about being a human. I almost said $5 word.
Yeah, that's okay.
A human person. It should be a person. and looking out for each other. And I saw a post that you just put, Stan, that video about, hey, take care of each other, even in the hood. That's what this was. She's just looking out for anybody, you know, and the news story had that Rosalind on there, and you know, she just said, and again, this is a 10-year-old girl who simply said, I just think these officers need a hug. We need them around. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything else about their background, but I thought that's pretty cool that here's this little young lady and her family, and they're traveling around and talks to the Waco folks, and they treated her like royalty, you know. Escort in the lights and sirens, brought up to the PD, and you know, the sheriff was there. They read a proclamation. I mean, it was a great, cool little event that I just personally was honored to be part of. I mean, it's just a cool deal to spread that type of information, and I'm proud that I was there.
I appreciate that, Chief, because that really, in this day and age, we really need that. Let me go up to. This is my ride or die, my go-to, my conciliatory, the person that when I don't know, and it can be 1 a.m, my time, and I call Joe picks up. I can call Joe will tell me, hey, man, I'm in the middle of a murder. Give me 10 minutes. And he'll call me back in 10 minutes and say, let me call you in about 2 hours. But he calls back. And, you know, everybody likes to say they're a ride or die. But when I call Joe calls me back. Joe picks up the phone. Hey, I'm busy. I'm in a murder. Let me call you back. But he picks up the phone. So for me, he holds a special place here and a special place on this show. Because if not many people will come into your life that way that you've never even met. So with that, Big Joe, what's going on?
This morning between John and the Chief, John, and I think Tony's wearing his wife's hat today, but I don't think testimony taking off this morning, and I just want to say thank you for allowing me to air. John always is amazing. Jim is always amazing. God came just because I can see in his face, you know, one part of me is reading language, body language, and John A. got it, so I'm there. But again, this hat is only that I was joking back to the wife.
Like all of you love my hat deep down inside.
Nah, bro.
No,
Tony, I'm just going to say I love you, brother, but when I saw that hat, I saw the village people. I was waiting to hear why.
The village people?
Oh, yeah, bro.
You see this cross on here?
I don't care about the cross.
Hey, don't forget the church mothers and their hats.
Yeah.
Really? It's all about the village. Can we get to the
show? All right. That's
kind of a lady ministry hat.
See, now, wait a minute. Hold on.
I got to
introduce this guy now because.
Wasn't it Dolly Parton wore that hat?
Hey.
What? No, wasn't Dolly Parton wore his hat?
Hey, Joe, I got to introduce him right now because that segue is typical Sergeant John Lovio to everybody. Retired Sergeant John Lovio, 25 years, same as me. High five, bro. Appreciate that. And I got to give him a shout-out because that snipe he put in, that's John. In the hood, in roll call, he could be sitting up at the front of the sergeant's desk. And you could be a little rookie up in the front rows, and you snipe something out, John will check you. Everybody else will sit there looking polite, and I'll just sit on the back row, you know. But I got it, my friend, I'm proud to call my brother. Not just because we were cops together. I could have met John anywhere. And because of his personality and his commitment to problem solving in communities, we would have naturally linked and bonded the way we do now. We've been through a lot together. And brother, you got all the time you need. Come on, let everybody know a little. Introduce yourself. Let them know about you. And let's go on and get into what you did there. That was amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, it's going to be hard to live up to that intro, but I appreciate that, Stan. And, you know, I feel the same way about you all the way. John Lovio, I'm a retired sergeant from the Waco Police Department. I came on, I stands right, it was at the height of the game award, the first round of the game awards, where a lot of people were getting shot in the territory. I think you and I got our master's degree in crime scene tape. I worked for the first, quick rundown of where I'm coming from, I worked the first 3 years, either north or east Waco, 4 years north or east Waco. Then I did a canine stint for 5. Then I went to narcotics where I did a lot of recovery work. And then, but even in narcotics, man, that's the crazy, I got to stop right there. The crazy part of the story is I virtually worked my entire career in north or east Waco. And for those not from Waco, what I'm talking about is those are small sections of the city. And when you're dealing with a criminal element in those sections, it's even smaller. Everybody knew me. Stan, I'm going to go ahead and cover it, Stan. So,
yes, the nickname.
I was actually given 2 nicknames. Mm-hmm. The first one was from Elizabeth Cedric Barnes on the north side. He originally called me Poindexter. He said I was a Poindexter looking, you know what? I was arrested one morning. But what it stemmed from is nobody could say Alobio. And so they were trying to figure out a name that could call me that they could pronounce. And so first it was Poindexter. They didn't really like Poindexter. And so the one that stuck and I've carried for 24 years is glasses. Because I wore glasses back then, like regular glasses. And Anthony Randolph gave me that name, who is still in. But all the wannabe gangsters and boys leave the block rock for rock, I was called glasses, and all the people, the nice people in the neighborhood, the folks that I was there to help, they called me Mr. Glasses. So that's to this day, the last day I left the PD, when I was Yo Hood, it was that. Am I still?
Yeah, we can still hear you. Your video was muffling there. But, yeah, we got you.
So for my career, I was one of the glasses in the hood, and you can dispense with John A. or John R. He's going to be glasses because that's what I'm getting the answer to. Eventually I'm promoted, and I went back to the east side again as a sergeant, and went to a Texas NA gang task force for about a year, 14 months, then I retired. So it was a good career, met a lot of good people, folks like Stan and some others at the PD, but really it was about the community. And there was about a six-month period where I got stuck in the nice part of town with all the nice houses, and I couldn't.
Were you uncomfortable?
I had to go back to the hood.
It was weird, wasn't it?
It was really weird. So the one thing that I will say about all those years of working in that environment, that low socioeconomic, hey, after 5 o'clock, I was the only white guy in that part of town. Was everybody was sincere. Whether they loved you or they hated you or they appreciated you or whatever the case may be, they were honest about it. They'd look you in the eye and they'd tell you about it. Mm-hmm. And I really, in all those years, I appreciated that genuineness that came that I didn't get when I went to the white part of town, the real upper end part of town with the real nice houses, that it would compliment you. But then the next day there'd be a complaint in your box because you didn't say or do something correctly. That you felt like that those citizens felt like they were owed for whatever reason. And I really enjoyed it. I couldn't get back over there quick enough. It was a great feeling to be able, that community is so on the edge socioeconomically, violent crime-wise, property crime-wise, every day they're on the very edge. And that is where, when you worked in that part of town, you saw where you had an impact. It was an instantaneous response. It was, you do something positive on a Wednesday for someone in that community, and you can see the payoff almost immediately just because they're so close to that ragged edge. In my police career, somewhere along the line, everybody's going to want to say, the old adage is 10%. All of the crime in a certain area is caused by 10% of the population. And that you have 90% of the population that are just there. They're along for the ride, whatever that ride is, whatever the positive or negative is, based on the impact of that 10%. So my objective every day was to impact the 10%. Because if you can impact the 10%, you can help the other 90%. And I can tell you, I worked over there all those years. There are some people in that neighborhood, very few, but there were some people in the neighborhood that probably didn't know who I was, but I like to think that because of what I did on a particular street corner or a particular neighborhood impacted them through the ripple effect. And I got feedback on the positive impact that I had from citizens, but I like to think that those that were a little further out, I helped them as well. So, I'm a white guy from Oklahoma.
We ain't gonna hold Oklahoma against you.
Yeah, sooner, probably. Everybody, let's throw that out there. It was to say that it was a change of an environment for me is an understatement. Because I went to the busiest shift in the nastiest housing complex in the city. You had corner boys on every corner leave the block. You had constant turf wars. You guys that have been in law enforcement know exactly what I'm talking about. And they were dropping bodies like it was nobody's business.
That's right.
I didn't see that. I saw that as a challenge, not as an intimidation. I saw that as a challenge because I had the opportunity to make an impact on that neighborhood based on what I did. And every officer, regardless, black, white, Hispanic, whatever their skin color may be, every officer impacts the neighborhood by what they do. If you are lazy and you don't take your calls and you blow things off, you have an impact on that neighborhood or that community. If you're a bully, if you go in and you bully the citizens, there's another, that's a whole different impact, but you're still impacting. And that's how I saw what I was doing when I went to work. I wanted to be the positive impact. People would come to me and say, hey, man, I'm trying to make a report with an officer on another shift, and for whatever reason the report didn't get made, I had the opportunity to fix that, to correct that problem by interacting with them. And so it was community policing. Without there being community policing, Waco, Hale, all cities, let's just say it, all cities, they talk about community policing, but all they really do is dip their toes in the water.
There you go. That part.
If you as an agency say, well, we are community policing based, and you're a 150-person agency, and you've got five people assigned to community policing, you're not a community policing agency. That's not an honest answer. Community policing is top-down.
That's crime prevention.
It's a total integration so that there is no scene. You have to be, as an agency, you have to be committed to community policing. You can't have five people in a 200-person agency and say, well, these are our community policing representatives. We've got the problem solved. You're not being honest with yourself as an agency. You're not being honest with your community. Every person has to have a stake in it. And that's how I saw it. And so that's how I tried to police. And at the end of the day, the gangsters hated me. Folks that weren't gangsters appreciated what I did. to me, that's a win. That's the objective, is to separate the those that are damaging the community from those that live in the community.
And so, John, let me do this before, because you're throwing out some good stuff right now. And before we even get to your program, you know, I mean, you and I, you know the love I have for you and what you've done. And so Stan ain't even going to, Joe and the Chief, I want them, I want you all to dialogue. And I want their comments on what you said, because I saw both of them nodding. And Joe has probably put more folks' murders in his career than I've ever invited to my house. You know, and I mean, he sees it. It's not a time I don't call Joe if he's at work. I'm on a murder. I'm on a way to a murder. And that shit takes a toll after a while. So, you know, Joe, come on in, brother. And you and the Chief and John, y'all take a minute and dialogue, and because this is good stuff right here.
Well, let me go first, because I got it. First of all, John, I had a nickname, but I'll leave that alone. And I think, at least on our side, those who are in the business, business, understand hypocrisy at its best. So Chicago has a community policing, and I can tell you that I know four outstanding officers who dig in their pockets. Now, if you've been in the business, you know what I'm talking about, Chief. You know, these guys dig in their pockets on a regular basis. I'm working at another agency where we have a lady that is so over the top in the community police, but can't get an ounce of help from the department, but they got the benefits of it. I got another detective who goes in her own pocket. We had an outing a couple weeks ago. She brings not only pads for your computer, she's got extensions, she's got water bottles, but yet some of the other commands that come up and they take pictures, look what our department's doing, but they won't give this lady a fucking dime. So for me, it's hypocrisy. You know, it's easy to talk about it. So for a long time, community policing was unfunded badly. Now, under Biden, it's picked back up. But the question really becomes, especially when you start looking at the budget, where's the money? Because it's bullshit, and everybody on this board knows that the top people are not giving the money to the programs. One of the guys I worked with, I think it was a former officer, is doing some other stuff. He has even run the baseball program out of his own pocket for almost 20 years. Marco Johnson, got a lady named Dahlia Gore-Reed. She writes books, she got plays. People don't even promote these things. The guys who ran the baseball, still running it, he runs the Spirit's fraternity. And the neighborhood gangs give them money for the gloves.
Yeah.
You know where I'm going with this. Had he been on the job, he could have taken the items or money. So how hypocritical is that?
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, he's hoping on the cover game. Man, I'm not going to turn these guys down. Now, in fact, they come out and protect the game. Yeah. What are we doing?
Yeah.
I mean, what John is saying is correct. I mean, like what he said, people in a 200-person department, and I know what he's talking about. That's true. I've said that. I don't know how many times I've said that on this show. There's a slide in the patrol section that I teach at the police academy. Every officer is a community police officer. It's not a specialized unit. You can fund it. You can get money. It's an ideal idea across the organization. That's what community policing is. And it's different for every entity. You know, so there are certain things that a larger agency in my county may do that's not going to work for me. There's some things that I'm going to do that are not going to work for another agency. So it's really dependent upon what you think the needs are for the citizens. You know, the baseball idea, I think that's fantastic, and supporting a team, you know. So it's multidimensional, and you can't just kick some people on it. I'm telling you, you can. You know, from multiple agencies. I've seen this state before. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It's got to come from the chief.
It comes from the top down. It's what's pushed down to the lowest level person of how this is supposed to work and the expectation for the community. That's it. And between all this, again, the community policing stuff that I do for my agency, I have a line on it. It's a couple grand. The majority of the stuff we do, it costs me the cop. It doesn't really cost me much of anything. You know, other than for a venue that hosts us. I mean, my people show up. I don't have to think. Most of them are on duty. They show up anyway. National Night Out, that's probably my biggest one. And we'll have several thousand people show up during National Night Out. Most of this stuff is donated. At least, you know, and that's just part of it. And I don't want to focus on that being community policing. Those are just pieces of the puzzle. It's how you operate on a daily basis to the lowest socioeconomic, downtrodden person that you have in your community. How do you deal with them and help them fix their problems and to create that impact, as John said earlier?
I'm doing good. We can barely hear you. Are you on the speaker?
I have headset on.
Okay, we got you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, how are you doing? I'm Janice. I'm a retired officer in Houston.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me give a – I got it. Thank you, baby, for calling. Let me give a – Janice Barnier.
Yes, that's
this
me.
Lady,
how are you doing?
I did it right, didn't I? You know,
right.
I'm going to tell you, y'all hearing this on this show, we come real 100. Nobody fake.
Okay.
Nobody. We're not like the cliques. And Dana Stevens hooked us up. And y'all know Pastor Dana. Dana came here and lit it up all day. And, you know, she and I texted back a few times, back and forth. And I was 7 minutes into the show. And I said, I'd love it if you could just chime in. Now, this is awesome.
Okay.
Introduce yourself, take your time, and please answer this show.
Okay, this is kind of my first time doing this, so I'm kind of, you know, how does this work?
Or you got you.
Okay, yes, I'm, like I said, my name is Janice Fournier, and I'm a retired officer. I formerly worked with the school district, and but I worked narcotics for 8 years, undercover, and let's see, I have been through the gamut. I have went through, like I said, with the community policing. I've done with the school policing. I've done you name it. And that's just kind of answering the questions, I think. I'm kind of like, you know, I'm kind of outside doing two or three things at one time. I was listening more so.
But, you know, you're in the brotherhood in here, the real brotherhood. Where we just,
I know it. I'm enjoying it. I love this guy. I love you guys. That is so wonderful. You know, it really feels like you're all alone when you're out there, especially when you run into a mm-hmm. bunch of bad guys that are supposed to be on your side. Because even with working narcotics, I had more fear of work with other officers than I did with the people on the street. Mm-hmm. I had never had a problem with them.
Well,
it was always
a
challenge. It was always a challenge being a female detective, too, because, you know, everybody always wanted to, well, do you know this, do you know that? You know, not as professional of that, what, you know, my experience is always a challenge of, well, can you do this or can you do that? You don't have to do my job. No, I know what I'm saying.
Yeah, your signal's kind of fading out a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I kind of moved to a space a little better.
Oh, no, you're good right there. Right there.
Okay. Okay. I'm having a frown because I'm losing you, too. Okay. Yeah, but I was very interested in listening to you, especially Chief and John. John sounds very interesting. You know, I've worked with guys like him before. And as you said, and I also work a multi-county task force. Well, I work in, I don't know if you're familiar with Montgomery County. And being only female and black officer out there, the camaraderie that I had with the other officers of the law, like, was so supportive. I really enjoyed and missed those guys. I've even had the opportunity of working with a lot of, I've had to go in and get in Klan meetings, and they were just so sweet to me, which was strange. A lot of people didn't understand that. Like, the respect that they showed to a female, even as an officer, was, you know, people didn't, but they couldn't believe that I could walk with them, talk with them, get them to explain what, you know, let me help them.
You know, I think that, you know, and what you're saying is true, and it really goes a little bit back to what John said, because Big John's not here right now, but what John said, I think that when we talk about ride or die, and
right.
You're sitting there, bushy-eyed, you want to get on this police department, you don't know anything about the police department, but you know what needs to be fixed in your community, and you know what
yes.
you need to be able to do it. But then you go to this police department, and John's situations, you know, I can tell you, I'm going to share personal stuff. John comes here from Oklahoma to Waco, Texas in the 90s. And they dumped his ass out in North Waco with me. Now, I don't know
yeah.
him other than I'm meeting this guy. And I look over and I'm like, okay, white guy, clean cut, uniform press. Oh, this is going to be interesting. So we get out the car. He'll tell you, my first thing was, you want to ride with Stan? And the mayor of Waco would tell you this. I ain't going to call him out by name because he rode
okay.
with me one night. The very first place we'll stop is Parkside Villages and get out the car. And we're going to walk. And we're going to meet people. And I will tell you, I'm about to introduce you to a murderer. Can we convict him of it? Do we have proof? No. But I'm going to tell you what I know for the street. You're going to shake hands or meet or talk to a murderer. You're going to meet a guy with holes in his pants who has more money in the bank than you're ever going to see in your police career. And guess what? He's 19.
Yeah.
And he took that challenge, and he listened, and he walked in there, and he made a difference. And if officers get nothing else from this show today, right or not, you know, what did you believe before you were indoctrinated to believe something else?
They know if you're real or not. See? You can't come in there if you're not real. They know.
You got a lot of background noise. It's kind of hard to hear you.
Okay. I have to keep moving from different areas. I say they know if you're real, if you're a real person or not. You can't come in that faith.
Let me let John answer that because he did undercover, and he knows. John?
Well, yeah, if you want to talk about the undercover stuff, first of all, I got to say the most amazing part of that was the same youngster that a month earlier I talked to two or three times a shift, I was now going out undercover and buying dope from him. And if you listen to the old Body Bug recordings, you hear me calling out my name as I'm driving up in the corner. You hear me say, man, I was thinking, is that so-and-so? And I just arrested last month. I roll up. I hold my 20 out. Man, they didn't even look at me. They didn't want that green. And they make me, I think, it was the craziest thing ever. But regardless of whether I was, whatever role I had, you know, my uniform days in Parkside Villages before they turned Parkside down, and those were just were great days for me. I had a blast. It was like I was going to work at a playground. I know that sounds wild, but you knew who all the players were.
Mm-hmm.
You knew where all the players were. You know how they ran their game.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, one of the things I think that worked best for me in my career is I always made it a point. Good person, maybe a guy not doing right, whatever it may be, I always made sure to remember their name. And that took me a long way in dealing with anybody over there, gangsters, you name it. Because when you step up on a corner and say, hey, so-and-so, why you been? How's your brother doing? When's he getting out? How's your mom? You know, your mom stays over on the when you look him in the face and you call him out by name, it almost, in some ways, it's a form of de-escalation because they're not expecting you to be able to holler at them by name and their brother or
mm-hmm.
how their mom's doing or any of that stuff. It completely changes the nature of the entire encounter. Even if I had to take them to jail, Dan will tell you. I took a lot of people to jail.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did.
But it was always, you know, I tell all those folks, I say, hey, look, man, we may be on the wrong side of the fence today, but if I see you out tomorrow, I'll say, hey, you know, we're good. I'm not, you know, this is what it is. But don't, you know, you play the game. We're both in the game. We're both playing the game. Today we lost. Tomorrow I'll probably lose. You know, that's just the nature of it. And when I treated it, it was still very personal for both of us. You took some of that animosity out of it. Even when you make contact, you know, you walked up and said, hey, so-and-so, I know you got some rocks in your pocket. Let's, you know, sometimes it's legal foot change and they get caught. Sometimes they just, it's towards the end, they just look at me and go like, yeah, you're right. And they pull it out of their pocket and answer. That's,
mm-hmm.
But you know, right? They're going to say thanks and time out, but it's not, you're not. That animosity is there. And I think that, you know, man, I got into a lot of stuff when I was working at beat. But, you know, I also had people that were, you know, I can think of a couple of fights where some others that maybe they weren't good people, they weren't bad people, they're just neighbors. They step in and say, hey, man, you need to get out there. He's one of the good ones.
Hey, John, let me ask you about this because people can hear you and with all the great things that you're saying. And I got to go into my little moment. You say what you want to say about it, or if you don't want to comment on it, you don't have to. I remember coming in to roll call one night, and yes, we all worked together, and I've said this, and this is Stan's personal opinion, and cops can get bent out of shape about it, can agree or disagree, I don't really care, or they can call. There's not a blue family. I don't believe in that. We bond with each other out there in the battle. And our wives understand. And when I say not a blue family, I'm not talking about the spouse, because they share the common sacrifice when we go out the door. But I came into work on the midnight. And, you know, things happen, and, you know, and I'm a human. Some people I lose sleep over. Some people, you know, that's bad that happened, but we won't. And I don't care whether folks take that the wrong way. And I came in and heard you were involved in an accident.
Yeah.
A bad accident that they didn't know whether you would make it through or ever walk again. And that kind of hit me because I'm going in roll call. And here's the John I know, my ride or die, my backup, that guy that's there with me, that's willing to fight with me. And it was earliest midway in my career, but it's a scary feeling to go to work, and you're working around all these people, and at that time, I had a good reputation there and all that. But all of a sudden, and just in a roll call announcement, I could be alone as far as who I could go to and talk to. And my ride or die. And that kind of hit me. Because you came back from some stuff. You didn't just live a pristine career.
No, you're right, Stan. I don't mind talking about it. I got to say this before I start this story. All those years of banging it out, Parkside Villages, all the rough stuff, all the stuff I've been through, and I got T-boned at an intersection, working a call, I got T-boned at an intersection by some Baylor kid. They'll do all that stuff, and they possibly get knocked out of the game by some Baylor kid.
you know, and I got one that's very, very, very close to me, and we're going to have her as a future guest on the show, Claire Van Wolf. Claire, young girl, she'll come tell her story of what she went through and the decisions that she made. But she's watching and she's, you know, tell Olivia we said hi. I mean, her story is phenomenal. When she comes and she tells it, and Chief, you may know about her story. You know, John, you know about her story. And, you know, I'm real impressed with her, and I got to give her a shout out because that I adopted her and she adopted me, and that's one of my baby girls. But, you know, let's we're going to transition here, and let me get Joe and the Chief, if y'all want to chime in there. Tony's gone, okay. Joe and the Chief, if y'all want to chime in before we move into the next segment where he actually talks about the program, because I'm liking this show so far.
It's funny, you know, he said some things that we need to clear up. Policing and education are almost the same field, believe it or not. The fact that we call people what we learn first name is something that educators do every day. We call their students by their first name. It's not necessarily disarming, but it's meant as a way to break the wall down. And so better officers do learn people's names because it shows that you take the time, it shows that you care. So I would highly recommend, so aside from calling people fast, whatever else, I recommend knowing their name. But again, that's something you learn from education. But it's true. You know, most criminals I know for still know. I know by their first name. It's not some, it keeps them up. Because again, I took the time, and I also took the time to learn who they're connected to, not because I need for criminal investigation, but I just took the time to understand all criminal bad. I had to take them. Some do not. Are they career criminals? Yes. All of them. If we were to take all these occupations and put a strain on them and say who's doing it for the good, who's doing it for the bad, you might be surprised if you're going to fill the problem. And that probably sounds crazy, but
it's true. I get the name thing with when y'all was talking about it. Of course, I don't get to do so much now in my current role, but you know, this is when I started out in Dallas back in the day, it's the same thing. Not only does the person's off-kilter a little bit, it also sends a message to their buddies, their running buddies, when they're all together. You get out of the car and you say, hey, you know, whatever his name is, you come here. The his running crew goes, ooh, and I don't know the name. Right, or a street name, right? It's actually better when you know the street name, but then you find out what their real name is, you know? And then it's like in marriage, calling you by your first, middle, and last name, you know, to go over and whoop your butt. So, yeah, I mean, there's a definite style, I would say, and that's what I call it, the style. It's a alert behavior on how to do this job. Again, I need to go back and talk. The officers are absolutely fantastic. Do great things to use. Some that suck because they don't know how to get put in. They don't get to have that situational awareness. They don't have that the mindset. They don't learn their community. They just go in there, chop off a few tickets, put some folks in jail. They don't solve the problem. You know, they'll get to know people. It's something that, as an administrator, you've got to push the people. You've got to push it down and let them know this is how things are going to work. Your John's story is very similar to mine. I did have a nickname. It was Devo. That was pretty quickly that it was given to me. But what you said, you know, I'm a kid from Plano, Texas. My first job is in Lancaster, Texas, basically South Dallas, I-20 and I-35. And I get pushed in the worst part of town. And Scott, here you go, rookie. I'm like, holy cow. So I had to learn to adapt from what I was used to what I was doing. And again, I realized it was more problem solving. Luckily, I had an administration that allowed us to
problem solve versus just chuck everybody in jail to create and fix these issues. And that 10% is absolute 100% accurate. 100% it will never change. But you do have that impact, no matter what you do. Right, right, wrong, or indifferent. You have an impact in the community when you walk in there. It'll be huge impact, no matter what you do or you don't do. Right, so do what you're supposed to do on that positive impact. And it's not about writing tickets and putting everybody in jail all the time. We don't know that everybody's sitting on here knows that. There are people that, there are bad people that have to go to jail. We know that. Everybody's got it. Right, just fix the problems. You fix the problem. The next time you see them, they'll become a problem. They become an advocate for you. And as Stan has said in the past, and I truly believe this for myself, that some of the safety, some of my safety early on in my career was provided by people in that community. Because it was simply, he's one of the good ones. Stay away from him. Don't jack with him. And there were some bad murderers. We had a specific park side. We had a park complex called the Chiefs. It was the same thing, right? I mean, there were some bad folks in there. So, some of that safety was provided to that officer simply by people that you had made contact with. So, everything so far is fine, man. I can't disagree with
that. Let's do this, Chief. While I have, especially, we're all cops here, and so I want to go deep into these young people who think they wanted to do this job, or I want to do it for whatever reason. They don't know. You don't know what, I don't care if your dad did it, your mom did. You don't know what this job is about until you get in it and you see the nightmares. And you really don't have it figured out till you hit the 10-year mark. That's when you really have it. John, you're my witness. I knew my community so well. Not because the police academy taught me, not because Waco PD taught me, but because the citizens trusted me and taught me. I could go to a drive-by. I could look at the shell casings on the ground and tell the detective who was there. John, am I lying?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, Dave, the fact that you committed yourself to move into the neighborhood. How many officers live in a neighborhood state police? That's even today, that's pretty extraordinary. And that's what, I think that was the main bridge of trust that you built with the community. You literally live three blocks from Parkside.
Mm-hmm.
You were hearing a gunshot before the 911 call was made.
Mm-hmm.
People realize that you were willing to make that, not a sacrifice, but make that adjustment in your life to be able to live amongst the people you're policing. And that's very rare.
I saw a lot
of the positive aspects that came from that.
And I had to be that way because I didn't know it at the time, but one of the things I will always say, and I'm very critical of some preachers, not all black, but just some inner city preachers, because I say, how can the shepherd lead the sheep if you don't live in the pasture? All you do is come in and count the slaughter. Joe, Chief, Janice, Mike is open.
It's interesting because, at least in a large municipality, you cannot police where you live.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when we're talking about the dynamics of community policing, we have to look at the dynamic and the shifting paradigm shift as to deployment of manpower and resources.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a thing, just what you guys talked about, a position where you can live in community and do your job probably more effective? Unfortunately, because we listen to older policing dynamics, that's not taking part in this.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are showing that it does. Now, again, we talked about this, but we have to look at the heads of these policing operations. They should take exactly what you're talking about and do that, but we don't. So now you can't have community policing. It's in a terrorist form. You're not really willing to invest
those officers back in the community, if that makes sense.
You know, Joe, in 1995 in Waco, 95-96, we had a female city manager, Kathy Rice. And one of the, you know, I had my issues with her, things that I didn't like, and things she did I did like. And one of the things that she did, and it was under, I think it was under a grant program at that time, but they took houses that were in, and I've talked about the three types of neighborhoods on previous shows. You know, your loss zone, your transition zone, and your change zone. In a transition zone, where the crime is there, you see it. You're not the loss zone, and you're certainly not the gated community. But they had a program where which they would allow officers to live in certain houses. They bring the houses up to code. And it's mostly single officers that would take advantage of this. You're coming to Waco. You're from Boston, Massachusetts. Carol, you need a place to stay anyway. You know, you come in. You don't pay any rent. You pay your utilities. You do everything a regular person would do. You didn't pay any rent. And after, I think it was, John, 5 years, you own that house.
Yeah. There was, I don't remember, it was 5 or 7.
Yeah. But you owned it.
At some point, you were given the house by the city.
Right. Now, that went away.
It was a HUD program.
Right. But
Right.
Now, that program went away. When it was effective, I mean, I didn't take advantage of it. I came out of the military and moved where I could afford to move to do what I need to do. But that's a good time to segue into, John, the program you did. Can you go into what you did, what motivated you to do it, especially with so much time, everything you've seen? It's very easy to say, to hell with those people. They're trash. They're drug addicts. They're, I don't give a damn. I got 5 years left. Let me ride it out, and I'm out of here. But you didn't do that. Can you talk about that for a minute?
No, so I eventually ended up on a day shift target spot in West Waco, which is businesses, apartment complexes, a lot of green belt zones. So as I got used to that district and started paying attention, really paying close attention to what was going on, what I saw was a lot of police resources being wasted on nuisance calls. So it's on a nuisance call. And what I'm talking about by nuisance calls are shoplifters where the people have already left the store, people at intersections calling in and complaining about panhandlers disrupting traffic. And so I got to looking at our call load in that district and saw how we were running so many nuisance calls that we weren't available during peak times to deal with crimes that actually needed to be dealt with. And so as I dug into it further, and I got to say, some of them were a little selfish because, you know, you don't like to see your people run ragged. What I realized was it was a homeless problem. The homeless they moved into that area of the city and established camp cities in the greenbelt zones. And as a result of that, we were being pummeled with call load. So Texas is a very strong property rights state. So if you're trespassing on somebody's property, you know, they get trespassed off and they start going to jail. Well, even a lot of the green zones out in that part of town are privately owned areas. So I started working with the local homeless program through our mental health. It's MHMR, but it's our mental health program here. They got a homeless outreach program to try to come up with a solution. And so what we ended up doing, the program that I ended up creating was, even though you're trespassing on somebody's property and you are homeless, we are going to give you a 7-day eviction notice. Now understand, we can show up and say, get your stuff and leave right now. You're out of here and you get a trespass warning, and if you come back, you're going to jail. Well, people's entire lives, basically at that point, are in a shopping cart, or where there's tattered on the ground, it's kind of heartless, really, to show up and come into a homeless person's camp and say, hey, you've got 5 minutes to gather up everything you've got or you're going to jail. And whatever you leave behind is getting trashed. Well, obviously, I got to back up because obviously those that were panhandling are living in homeless camps. So obviously the first step is to talk to business owners. We have a lot of Union Pacific Railroad runs through that part of town. There's a lot of encampments on the Pacific Railroad property. Get all the, for lack of a better term, I don't really like this term, but I'm going to use it. You get all the stakeholders involved. Get updated trespass warnings. Get all the paperwork in order. Then I would go out to the encampments, and I would take MHMR representatives with me, and they would get served with a 7-day eviction notice off of somebody else's property. I explained that to the business owners. They said, man, we're good with that. That's fine. We understand that there's a human component to this. And I would take homeless representatives with me. MHMR outreach, because we have a large Veterans Administration hospital here that deals with mental health crises and substance abuse of a portion of our homeless community, our veterans. So I got all of those folks together. We would go out in like a, for lack of a better term, a mini task force. They would interview folks, figure out what they needed to get off the street, how they could solve that particular person's problem. A lot of the homeless people were people that had previously been involved with MHMR, but had basically fallen off the scale. They lost contact or moved to another homeless encampment or whatever. So that's the human component of it. So the enforcement component of it is the McLennan County Sheriff's Office has an environmental impact unit that deals with dumping, illegal dumping, or large areas where trash are at. So at the end of that 7 days, and I would explain it to them, hey, in 7 days, we're coming back. Whatever you haven't pulled off, it's going to get scooped up by a giant bucket truck and hauled to the city dump. And so it's a twofold. And I know, Stan, that there are going to be some folks on your radio that are listening in right now that are going to say, they're homeless. They're not bothering anybody. Why not just leave them alone? Well, besides property crimes, car burglaries, shoplifting, all of the petty crimes that are out there, you have to deal with the fact that every homeless encampment that I went into, the people were using 5-gallon buckets for solid waste. They crap into a 5-gallon bucket, and then they haul it 10 or 15 yards away and dump it. So you now have got some environmental issues. Some of the larger encampments were even, they lived next to concrete rain culverts, and they would take logs and stick, and they would dam up the culverts, and that is where they would dump their waste. And when it got ready to rain, they'd go down there and move the logs to let the trash, to let the rainwater wash their toilet out. So there's a lot of aspects there that are just, it's not a healthy place to live. You're spreading disease, and you've got this criminal element. So let me just cover that because I had to deal with some of that when I started this program at Waco, because citizens that maybe didn't understand what it really meant to be homeless had it explained to them.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the 7 days, we would show up with, we had a schedule that we would run, and the environmental guys in the sheriff's office would show up, and we would dismantle homeless encampments. So the reason for that is this. People will always find a justification in their mind to live in some horrendous places under some horrendous conditions. Stan, you know, when we worked the bad, the crackhead neighborhoods, you have crackheads living in houses that had no electricity, no running water, and they'd use the bathtub as a toilet, and the bathtub would be completely full of feces, and they'd just start using buckets. horrendous in 110 degree heat.
Mm-hmm.
Those people still found a way to justify that they were living okay in their minds. Without intervention, without some type of intervention, people are going to live that way. People are going to just accept that this is my lot in life. So by removing one of the thoughts that worked was by removing that homeless encampment, by taking that, what the homeless person would describe as a safety net, and instead not really giving them an option, but giving them an option to either get help from MHMR or one of the other services out there to get some type of temporary housing, to get something set up so they can start the path back to not living in the woods and crapping in a 5 gallon bucket and being preyed upon by all the other homeless people because sexual assault and aggravated assault are very common in those encampments. So you've got to break that apart to make people want to improve their lives, to give them an impetus to start the road back to some sort of what we would consider a normal life. So on every Thursday, we would have a set of homeless encampments that we would go either visit with this task force, or if we'd already given the notice, remove the encampment so that they could start getting some help. And some of the encampments were very large. The largest that we dismantled was 83 tons of trash, debris, and feces. That is a huge number. It's a camp that has been there for 67 years, 10, 20 or 25 people living in it. And they really, you know, the only way they survived was, and they would tell you, you know, I sit down and talk to them, you know, hey, you know, they'd ask me, you know, why are you doing this? And we talk about it. All right, listen to while MHMR visited with those folks. And they say, you know, we survived by stealing. You know, the encampments that were down by Baylor University, it was bicycles and whatever else the Baylor students would leave laying around, mostly bicycles that they would resell. You know, West Waco, it was shoplifting from Walmart or Academy or Lowe's or whatever store they had figured out an angle to steal from. So in the time I ran that, I continually watched the numbers for the call load for the department. We had a 12% decrease in call load in that district in the time I did that. I felt like it was at a point where all of the bones had been worked out of it. It had the potential to have its own legs and stand on its own. Unfortunately, I transferred to the TANG program, and for whatever reason, that program just withered and died within the department, which was kind of disappointing to me because there was an opportunity where everybody wanted to work together for a common goal. From agencies, we would get Waco utilities and street departments all wanted to volunteer people for that because they could see that there was a good coming from it. And so there was a lot of genuine effort put in by a lot of different departments within the city. And it ended up dying on the line. Now our homeless problem probably is bad as it ever was.
John, let me ask you this. Let me stop you for a minute because I want to rewind to an important part, and then we got a caller I want to get to. You know, you weren't mandated to do this. You,
it was a needs assessment.
Right.
I did the needs assessment, what needed to be done.
Now, when you did the needs assessment and you sat down and did all this work, you were at the house?
Yeah, I did some work at the house.
Okay.
Because, you know, sometimes my days wouldn't necessarily integrate with what we had to do.
Right. Right. So you saw all this and you gave a shit. You know, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to answer. But what you did was really beyond community policing. You hit the definition right earlier when you said it's just policing, and Joe seconded that. Did you get the naysay, the blowback? Why are you worried about these people? Why do you care? Did you get that? If you did, in the side remarks, how do you, and I know what it's like to go home and grapple with it, and still you hear from the people you work with, but you have to go out here and deal with the people you work for. How was that struggle?
And I'm not speaking ill or anything. What had happened with that district and the officers working beats in that district was they had simply gotten used to the fact that they were going to go from call to call to call throughout their shift. They were basically in a drone mindset. So when I started doing this, it was the officers that worked under me that were in that drone mindset that said, why are we doing this? Why are you messing with this? Why? What? This doesn't make any sense to us. And I would say to them, if you give it some time, you're going to see your call load fall. Maybe get the usual skepticism, you know, that's a bunch of garbage, you know, that's not going to happen. But when it did start to fall, you know, then I got to say, see, I told you so. And they were questioning. They're like, hey, my call load's falling. I'm digging this now. Mm-hmm. But it just took someone, to show them that there was a better way to police.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just in this drone mindset of going from call to call to call. Because then, when you're all tied up on calls, and a real call for service comes in that you really
got
to be...
You got nobody to say.
Yeah. Then there's this turmoil within the district. Like, hey, how are we going to handle this? What are you doing? I'm on this call. And you hear the officers talking back and forth on the back channel, like, hey, you know, I'll take this. Or there wasn't any need for that. If you address the core problem that's driving these nuisance calls, now you've not only got some free time to go eat or do whatever, you've also got you're free to answer calls for service.
But you did say, John, I gotta before I go to this caller, you said free time to go eat. Let me make this clear to everybody that's listening from Waco. Unless things have changed, John, if I'm wrong, you certainly tell me. Waco PD never has a lunch hour. When you go to work, if you eat, there are days we work 10-hour shifts. You don't get a lunch. There is no designated lunch break. We don't get to say, I'm out at lunch. So when you see four cars at a restaurant, you wonder, why are all four there? It's quiet. And here's the side of it that I want people to understand that we've done a lot that the community doesn't know. When you order your meal and you're waiting on it, and it's $8-$9, and you get a call, you don't come back to that restaurant, and you're out $8 or $9. So Waco PD patrol officers do not have a designated lunch break where I've got 15, 20, 30 minutes to eat. You can quite literally, in the summer in 100-degree heat in Waco, Texas, you can show up for work. You can show up for work at say the 3 to 11 shift, at 3 in the evening. And you may not eat till 11 at night. And you may have to go out there and fight somebody not having had anything to eat.
It's true.
And if you can stop, if you have time to stop and get a Big Red or a Dr. Pepper and a bag of Doritos, that is the truth. It has been that way my whole 25 years. It was that way. There was never a designated break point where these officers could sit down and eat. So that's important to put out, and I wanted that out because I hear people say, well, I saw four patrol cars at Taco Bell. Go ahead, Chief.
That's why we tell officers get a jug of water. You can see a jug of water and a bunch of protein bars. Get them in the car.
Yeah.
We're the same way. We don't have a designated lunch break. Now, the difference between us and you in my community versus in Waco is we don't have a call. So there's an opportunity for them to eat. But there's not a designated time. And even where I was at, there wasn't a designated time. That's commonplace throughout law enforcement. And just like you guys talk about where it used to be,
I've bought chunks of drinks and all kinds of food out the window because I'm going to that next hot call. It's again, drive. This is before cup holders, folks. Put your soda in the other junk and you can't drive running ice and sunscreen with one hand on the wheel and one hand holding your drink. So, and many a cold water burger, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yes, sir. But a cold water burger is better than no water burger.
Don't worry, that's right. You're right. You know, the joke for us used to be, so why aren't you guys eating coffee and donuts? Well, hell, where I work, they weren't eating coffee.
You were lucky if you left the parking garage.
Your guys, the department I'm working with us, runs a 12-hour shift. And the main 12-hour shift with six offices with a city of 25,000 to 30,000. So you go from bing, 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 bing. And then, you know, one of the things that China has, and the chief, everybody's heard me say this, is the leadership that's involved.
That's right.
It's the stone cold leadership. I mean, John, if you think about the program, chief, look, man, again, I give you a lot of props. I mean, I wish we could clone your app,
as praying for cross officers.
But the fact of the matter is, John, your program is great. I know a bunch of guys run great programs, but when they leave, it withers and I don't find because it's not conducive to some other people. And here's another thing, let's talk about this that goes along with all of this. People talk about quotas. We don't have quotas. Yeah, we do.
Yes, that's right.
Discretion and policing. So when we're talking about community policing, we're really talking about discretion. We're really talking about empowering those officers to make those calls, to not to arrest or not to arrest, to follow up whenever they can, to do the best they can do. We're not doing that. So when you talk to these young kids, this ain't the profession. That's the
right.
I want to say something about that because the, like, we talk about that. I don't want to get this call, but the discretion issues is huge. And you're at least in Texas, you've got relentless possession, you've got somebody trying to take away that officer discretion. It's happening at the federal level. And I think what people don't understand is how powerful and what an impact that has. So just in John's program, right, you don't get that issue, and they just come in there, just as he said, get your crap, you got 5 minutes, let's go.
That's right.
But they use that discretionary tactic to solve the problem. And so there are some people in the government that don't understand that impact. And how powerful that is and what that stuff does in order to solve problems. So you're understanding correct, Joe. These young guys coming in today, young guys and gals, they don't see what we have. You know, we talked about the dump of the marijuana, the small amounts of marijuana on the side of the road. We did it in 2009, quite a bit. I can admit it. But Sam Mason is an example. He did it in Waco when he beholds to a different standard than Jim Devlin.
Probably right now.
and that's true. It's true. But the issue is that's discretionary tactic. If I was going to take some 18-year-old kid, pop him for a Class B misdemeanor, send him out of county jail for possession under two, right? Rather than, or make him go a city route, you know, which I always love our city judge, you know, paraphernalia, right? Put him in a drug recognition or drug program. Right. We're doing the same thing.
And you know what, Chief? For people who would say, I don't see that, 678, call, hang on one second, we're going to get you. You know what? Try walking back to your car, and you're looking at the computer screen while you're trying to figure out what the hell you're going to do with this misdemeanor marijuana. I mean, it's so much that you had to have more windows up so it didn't blow out. You got two sexual assaults holding. Two aggravated assaults, three burglary motor vehicles, and a shooting. And then while you're going, what do I do next? Oh, now we got a shooting in progress. And you want to go to the jail and deal with this misdemeanor marijuana bullshit for an hour and a half. That's crazy.
Well, you're obviously correct. And I'm just going to speak before you get to the call. I'm going to say that what John did, that is capitalism.
policing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you like it or you don't.
101.
It's not right and big. It's a problem. And I'll say it's a great idea from an exceptional employee that came up with that and solved an issue. And I can speak to it because I listened to the radio traffic. I heard the shoplifters at Walmart and the Academy and the crap that they kept doing. And that bit into so much time,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
that you have to solve the problem to deal with whatever else was going on. The things will solve, the shooting in progress,
mm-hmm.
being available in the neighborhood and proactive. Because when you're sitting on it, the shoplifting call that Walmart is not going to prosecute anyway.
Amen. Amen.
You're eating up that resource of that officer that can be in that area that they need to be in. That they can't lose it. So solving this problem, putting forth the effort, that's something like that.
Let me grab this caller real quick from the 678 area code 1436. Good morning.
Good morning, Stan. How you doing, my brother? This is Mike Gay.
All right.
I was trying to listen to it on the phone. I said, let me go ahead and get on the computer here. But I want to take a look here. I pulled up this page here that says pros versus cons as far as police officers living in the neighborhood, being residents in the neighborhood. And I'm pretty sure you know here in Atlanta, they started that program here, and they were doing it pretty much in the Grant Park area. And they were saying the pros and cons, and I was looking at these two individuals, and one of them obviously is an officer. I believe both of them are. They were having a little conversation. If you check out his police1.com. But something that this person said, I was wondering if you can elaborate on this. Was this ever an issue for you? They were speaking about officers who move into the area, and in fact, he says pictures of burned and spray painted patrol cars in front of residences where officers park their take home cars are certainly disturbing. The reality for most officers, though, is that they are appreciated by their neighbors, whether a marked car is parked
Absolutely.
Or not. But still, there are still individuals who, you know, will still put some threats. Did you ever have to go through
yeah,
that, Lisa,
friend.
Because
yeah,
because the things that were, yeah,
way,
did you ever have to go through all that a lot?
No. The best way I can explain it, and John will tell you, I lived in Hell Central. I had one of the biggest drug dealers in Waco lived across the street from me.
Uh-huh.
Who did his time, and I communicated. In fact, when they raided his house, I came out in the Academy and said, bring his wife and kids in our house, so they don't have to sit on the sidewalk and be filmed by the media. Here's the straight up about it. You got
mm-hmm.
asshole officers. Some are black, some are white, Hispanic, male, female, whatever. They're like shoes. They come in every size and every color. And if you're a jerk, I don't care if you live in a gated community. You're going to have issues. Because the fact of the matter is, not to go there, but I understand the statistic you threw out. But I can tell you, there are communities in America that are considered your well-intelligent, articulate, successful communities that everybody's got a $1 million home. But if I go buy a $1 million home there, I'm not staying. I'm staying with the qualifier, the black guy down the street. So, you know, I mean, America will always find a reason not to communicate, not to associate, to be different. But I know plenty of officers, and white, and Hispanic, male, female, who live in these criminally challenged neighborhoods, not just in Atlanta, but L.A., D.C., Chicago, Baltimore. They can call here. They don't have those problems. Most criminals, they understand this. And this is what civilians don't understand. Criminals understand it. Cops understand it. It's a game out there. It's business. And respect is everything. It's their job not to get caught. It's our job to catch them. And
right. If
you play the game fair, they will back you. I have more support from the so-called bad element in Waco than I have from some of the people who I worked with. Real talk, not taking a shot. I'm just going to be real about it because some of them have called this show and said so.
Mm.
So, John, Joe Chief, if I'm wrong.
First of all, the program is called Officer Next Door. It was a national program, and it was a HUD-funded program.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Did it work? I can tell you in most cases it did, because you'll find
mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be protected, even the criminals.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were doing the what I find, or at least some of my research, was that it's always the mischievous characters. You have to wonder which one is targeted and which one happens then. I can tell you this, in most cases, it was not necessary to be that officer. It was just some butthead wanted to prove a point and look what I did.
Right.
You know, so you got to be careful of that. But if you go and talk to most people, I have neighbors. I used to drive a squad car, but that's I loved it. They were like, hey, can you bring two of them motherfuckers on?
You're an officer. An officer that the store program was successful.
Like everything that works.
Officers, most officers can't live in the community they police because they don't get paid enough. Let's just get that out there because that's legit, right? NYPD, if you work for NYPD, if you're living out on Long Island somewhere and you're doing a 2-hour commute, I know because I got family that drives to the city and work the Bronx or down in Manhattan. They can't live there because it costs too much. That's the first thing. It's across the nation. The program allowed an officer, a new officer in family, to get into his home, an actual home, brick and mortar home, to live in the community at a reduced price. Okay, now that's one like that's a good deal, right? The other one is to serve the community. It's just a joke. And everybody wants protection. Even if you got a hook living across the road from you, his mom wants protection.
Right.
His dad, his uncles, his family on the street, they want protection as well. So they should bring it back. So they call the president, let him know, let's bring the thing back because it will work. The other thing is, yeah, you know, because I know you have the direct line, but the other thing was the squad car program. I'm just going to talk about that and talk about the caller. There's enough data out there at take-home car programs. And you can make a decision on what that does. There's enough data out there and the impact that has on the community. 99% of the city wants to see that squad car in their neighborhood, right? They find it. We get longer life out of the cars. There are more benefits to that than to outweigh any of the negatives. I've got an unmarked unit sitting out that way, and everybody knows what it is. Everybody knows who lives here. But they, I don't know if I've ever asked my neighbors, are you happy that I bring my car home? But I can guarantee you they sure are. You know, so I got people showing up at my house to report stuff. They know who I am. It's not like I'm living in secret. So, but yeah, I mean, I think when you see this image of a car being spray painted or set on fire, I think it's exactly what Joe said. It's some knucklehead that went by and wanted to try through the point. It's got nothing to do with individual officers. It's a status thing against the unit.
And Chief, before I go back to that caller, I want to add this caveat in because I think it's very important for folks to understand this who have never been in policing. It's very easy to mandate and regulate that all officers live in the city. I raised two kids. I raised mine in Waco. Fortunately, my kids never had a problem because just by virtue of, I guess, whether it's my human nature or where I worked or whatever. But when you ask an officer to go to work and deal with all these problems in that city, and have their kids go to school and have to put up with your dad arrested this person, your daddy's this, and then their kids come home with a mental basket case, that now they have to deal with that also. Is that fair? So we got to really be very careful when sometimes the community gets into absolutes. Every officer who works for our city should live in our city.
Well,
and then I say,
first of all, let me make that mandate. It's generally you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make a living in the city. That's a violation of an individual's rights. You can incentivize it, but I can't make my individual work or live in the community. Mm-hmm. Well, number one. Number two, the majority of them that I have can't afford to live in the community. So, you know,
But if the city pushes it as a condition of hire for somebody who's trying to get a job, they're going to do whatever, you know.
You can have a response.
Right.
An emergency response, a 30-minute window.
Right.
Emergency recall. That's fine. most of my people have that ability to do that anyway. But I don't know what Joe's got to say, because he has a finger up.
It's a couple of things I got to address. If we look at the mass shooting in Vegas of the Israel, the guy was shooting up the
hey, Sam.
They responded, and I talked to the sheriff and a lot of other agents. They were able to get a unified response because those officers did live within 10 miles and had those take-home cars. Now, the flip side to that is, at least in Chicago, our officers cannot live outside the state. I think that's going to be a bargaining chip. I think you shouldn't relegate. I mean, like you said, Chief, you look at New York, you look at California, they can't afford to live in that city because it's too expensive.
Friends that work for LAPD, a second lieutenant, a captain, and they live in Orange County. They commute with a group of officers to go to work. And the second lieutenant or captain's got a, he's running a gang unit in East LA, in the detective division. So he drives in with five or six officers every day to go to work because he just simply can't afford to live there.
We're at the 18-minute mark.
You can't put an arbitrary limit. Joe, a good example, especially for Chicago, is just because it's geographically laid out, you can live inside the city limits and still have a longer response time than living outside of the city limits and living closer to where you were.
I'm gonna go to this caller real quick, but I gotta say this, Joe. You're 100% on point. See, this is the problem. America has been so ripped apart and torn apart into where, when we say police reform, that means the citizens are over here and the police are over here, and somehow we tend to forget that police officers are, guess what, y'all? Citizens. They're citizens of somewhere. It may not be where you live. And I said this. And I don't want people to think this is the anti-police show for all the people locally down there where you are, Chief, who will go around the water coolers and stand there and ask the police. You know, even though we've done five shows, I'm going to help. But I'm going to say this. You know, I know more police officers are giving everything they have. Chief, you just said it. We talked about living in the community. Let me drop a bomb, and I don't take shots, but I'm going to take one here. And I'm not going to blame it. So anybody go say Chip and Joanne and Magnolia. No, I'm proud of them. Do your thing. Make your money. I said that in the interview. But I'm going to say this. Right now in Waco, Texas, WACO, only four letters. It's not a whole lot to it. There are police officers, firefighters, nurses, doctors, teachers, and every other middle-class income there, fighting to live right there. If you said, we want you to live in the city, they can barely afford to now with the cost of living. They're struggling.
Really taking off, Joanne. You're right. And I don't want, you're right. I'm not throwing stones at them. They're being successful. It's a ripple effect of their success. But Waco has become so popular that the property values here have just skyrocketed. They're out here just out of control. And so my wife and I are looking for a house here in the area. We've been looking for about a year and a half. The majority of the houses that are being sold to people from out of state, mostly California,
mm-hmm.
and they're being bought as
400,000 for a shack, John.
Real estate investment is what it is.
$400,000 for a shack.
We're getting to that point. We're getting close to that point. And the what houses are available are sold within hours, not even days, an hour. And it's all out of state.
But John, I don't want to take the show all the way down to Southern Tampa. But let me just ask, you know, especially you and the chief that are there. This is where I get really pissed off. because I work with a lot of good men and women who bust their ass, who aren't making, for Waco cop, you make good money. You make a hell of a lot better than any other city employee. But you're struggling to make your ends meet. Your teachers, everybody who is the backbone of that community, they carry that damn community. They teach your kids. They nurse the sick. They cut the trees. They trim the sidewalks. And pretty soon, this is my fear for the people who built that city. My fear is what happens when they wake up and they say, I'm going to Bell County where my taxes are not out the ass, where it's cheaper for me to live. I make more money. Now, guess what, Waco? You're building million-dollar hotels, but there's nobody there to make the beds.
People are already starting to move to the outlying counties because of the decreased tax rate. That's already happening. I'm staying there. And what you're creating is you're creating a commute industry. People are no longer going to live in Waco. Mm-hmm. They're going to commute in just like the other large
transits. But anyway, let me grab this caller real quick till we get the final remarks, because they call up from the 254. I always got to acknowledge Waco. 254 area code 4969. What's up?
Hey, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Hey, Officer Stan. Hey, this is Brother Reggie.
Hey.
What I was saying is, you know, trying to be friends with police officers. I used to have a friend called, his name was Willie Bates. Before he became a police officer, we went to TSCI together, taking dental lab, and we smoked weed together, and everything. And I lived on campus, had an apartment, but I also had a trailer over there in Belle Meade. And sometimes I let him use it, he'd have a girlfriend come over there and, let him use the apartment, go tighten her up or whatever, and come on, bring my key back. Did that several times. But anyway, after he became a police officer, then he wasn't bringing this girl over to have sex with her or nothing, because she was another police officer. I don't remember her name or nothing, but he brought her over to my trailer after I graduated, just a couple years later. And, snooping around, looking, like, I don't know if he had a quota to get, like if he was like, okay, well, I know this guy, used to smoke weed or whatever, let's go just snoop around. And so it's kind of hard to be friends with police officers, cops, whatever you want to call them, when, some of them are kind of, I don't want to say shiesty, but, it's like, come on, man, I don't know what to say. What is that?
You know, Red, to that all I'm going to say is this. And this is what I want the community to understand. I know we've been branded as heroes and patron saints and angels and superhuman and Marvel heroes. We're not. We're people. Okay? We're just as effed up as everybody else, and more so. Why? Because everybody out here that's not a cop, you get to have your own mental crisis in your head. You create it. You're the reason it's there. But we bring everybody else's mental crisis home on top of our bullshit. And all of it mingles together. And when you get into 15 and 20 years, of all you can compute in your head cannot even figure out. I'm talking from personal experience. Sometimes you can't figure out if one and one is really two. Because you're so convoluted with problems and things that need to be done. What does the job want from you? What do your coworkers want? What does your wife want? What do your kids need? What do I need to do? And I'm not making excuses for him. I'm speaking of policing overall. And society needs to come to the grip, the reality that we've been saying on this show. Police officers come from the community. We are a byproduct. And I will not let anybody give the few bad apples. That's bullshit. I will not let that go. The apple cart is rotten. Not the orchard. The apple cart is rotten. So it's bigger than the few bad apples. But, you know, I mean, I know officers who have done stuff, whether it's whatever, with whoever's whatever. That's their ghosts and demons they got to deal with. And I, for me, I can say what Dan does, didn't do, John does, John didn't do, Joe, Chief, you know, brother, I fear you. And I think your point is, it's hard for me to say I trust police and I trust cops and I trust this image America puts up when I know better. And brother, you had the courage to come and say it.
Right.
And sometimes that's what it takes. That's enough.
Now, part of that problem is that we as a profession are not living up to the expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of what it boils down to. Now, I'm not being a superhero. I'm talking about all the other stuff. We as a profession, the problems that we see, the things that we are suffering now, we are the cause.
And we are suffering.
Officers that should have never been hired, that, you know, their actions or behavior or lack of action or whatever it is that they've done,
we're
sufferers. We're the ones that suffer.
Well, if you listen to what John said earlier about 10%, it's why I said it across the country. But here's the other thing you got to look at. Does poverty drive regeneration in our case? I don't care if it's Waco.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it's Canada.
Absolutely. For sure, we can't use the term gentrification on this show. It's antebellum reconstruction.
Yeah. And it's across the nation. Again, everything that you guys are saying is an interesting thing. Is there a difference between a criminal from Waco or California or Chicago?
Hell no. Location.
So that reminds me, before I get any further, I got to say this. I still got a bowling pick with an area commander up in Chicago, and I don't know who it is. I hope you can help me find him. When I was doing my homeless program, part of the time I was doing that, it was cold out, and there were five guys standing around a 55-gallon barrel burning some wood. You don't see that in Texas. As soon as I saw those five dudes, I said, they're not from around here. So I drove over and I said, hey, man, where y'all from? They go, we're from Chicago. I said, what thing did Waco? He said, some area commander asked us if we wanted to go to Waco, Texas, and he bought us a ticket straight out.
I can guarantee you they lie because ain't nobody big got the money to spend nobody.
Hey, let me do this, you guys. We're at the 6-minute mark. We want to get out clean, but we're going to get out with final remarks. Let me go. Janice, I know you've been waiting, baby. Thank you for being patient. You know, if you got about 1 minute, and I'm going to call you after the show. We're going to talk.
Okay, I appreciate that.
All right, you got any final thoughts you want to add in before we press on?
No, I'm very impressed. I really enjoyed listening to you guys.
All right, baby. I'm going to call you here and probably within the next hour. So don't panic. If you see a 254, it ain't no bill collector. It's me.
You better tell me.
Okay. Hey, bro. You know how it is nowadays. We all got to put that warning out, man. You know. Let's just call me.
You know to come at me right.
Yeah, and Brother Reggie, now you down there in Waco,
right,
brother, take a minute, talk about what you do down there in Waco, because we know each other personally. And I talked to your wife this morning. She told me what y'all did with that picture, and that's real cool. But take a minute, talk about yourself.
Hey, man, you know, I'm just up here shining, you know, I shine shoes at the Waco Hilton on 4th and Austin at the Roosevelt Tower and out here at the fairgrounds. And it's a privilege and honor to sit at the feet of strangers You know, Jesus washed the 12 disciples' feet. A lot of people feel like you got to be up and mighty, high CEO and this and that. But it's an honor to just meet people. I meet so many amazing people down at Hilton. I mean, that's Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, you know, and NFL player. So it's an honor and a privilege. And I like it. Man, I love your show. And I love all the people that's on your show. And y'all continue to let your light shine as well.
I appreciate you, brother. Where y'all got my picture hanging? In the pantry? No, she told me where it is.
It's right there over the little bar area.
Can you say again that the interlopers interrupted you?
I said it's right over the little bar area.
There you go. Good place for it. That's the perfect place. Hey, Red, I appreciate you, man. Love you guys.
All right, much love. Yes, sir. Much love and respect to you. Y'all take care.
All right, brother. I appreciate you.
Yes, sir.
All right. Yeah. Hey, you know what, though? This brother, man, I got to say this. And you know, I didn't ask him, but I'm going to say it because they're Facebook friends of mine. This one impresses me about that. When I'm talking about folks who are doing... Reggie's got one leg. And shines two shoes every day.
Every day.
His wife has one leg. And stands stronger than a whole lot of women I see begging on Facebook or falling down on Facebook. Always in need of something. You know, it's to acknowledge them. But I like to give a little bit about who I am, Joe or Chief. What makes me tick? It's people who I have so much more than who remind me, get out of your pity party, just by posting a picture. They don't have to text me or call me. People who share.
That's your strength thing, Stan.
Oh, yeah. All day. All day, bro. John, take this last minute, brother. Come on in. In fact, let me see where I'm at. Yeah, you got about a minute.
You want me to
turn? No, I want you, man, give your final thoughts, brother, because we're going to have you back. I hope you don't run away.
No, I'm not going to.
You don't work there no more. You can talk now.
good show today, Stan. This is the first time I've had a chance to interact with everybody. We have the right ideas, you know. It's just a matter of getting them applied. The only thing I can think of that I'd like to go back and cover for about 40 seconds is, Keith, you talked about, and Joe, too, about the loss of the ability to, you're stuck in a mindset, you're stuck in a path. You can't, man, I just drew a blank on the word, but
discretion,
thank you. There's no discretion left. And the more you dehumanize law enforcement, the further you push us away from society. That ability to have the discretion to make decisions that are small decisions on our end but have huge impact on the other side. I understand the will for technology, and I understand everybody wants body cameras, but they also have to understand that comes with a loss of discretion, because now everything is under review. The decision you make on the side of the road is now recorded, and as the supervisor has the ability to review that and decide whether you make the right decision. So I think body cameras are a very positive thing for law enforcement. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is you have to be careful in how you apply body cameras. Because the more you strip discretion away from the officer, the more you are going to separate our ability to help you in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
100%.
Yeah.
Okay, now, if the block talk goes out, don't worry about it. I've got the phones turned down. We're all on the YouTube, so we'll go and let everybody get their final thoughts. And if it, this one, spontaneous. So we may go into something else and go all the way down the road, but that's what we're going to do. Because I, you know, we're all, we don't know if we're going to meet here next week, fellas. We don't know in this day and age. So we're here with all this collective wisdom here. We're going to do what we do and carry on. And let me see. Big Joe. Come on, bro.
With that pressure, good.
I know it.
Yes, indeed.
So fresh.
Yes, indeed. That's right. It's like green. I just couldn't get the moves up. You know what I'm saying? But I will say this. That's a great conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think y'all are on the same page. The idea of the body cast, let me just say this. Let me back up. As a detective, I have a problem with body cams because not only are they foilable, but the question that I have to ask, my detectives have to ask, should not be foilable and it should not be valuable. However, they are. So I've had to take another route, legal, but I have to take another route, and that's not something for discussion. But the discretionary part of this is totally going out the window. And we are throwing a big job in the fast part.
Mm-hmm.
In Illinois, they just changed the law with juveniles are now 21 and under. Now, how does that apply? For us that are in the field, it means a whole lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't talk to that 18-year-old murder suspect
without a mask
before, or he should be talking to him. Because now I have to treat him as a juvenile. But let me go a little bit further. I mean, this is where I'm going to walk over. The people that made this law, the people, the legislators that put this into effect, are theoreticians and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Never have they been the practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
I've argued, and I continue to argue, if you don't vote, this is what you get.
Amen. Say it again.
Everything that we do is based on electoral and elected.
Joe, say that again for the people in the back that can't hear you.
Well, they don't listen. I mean, I get so many emails saying, oh, that voting don't make sense. It's just a black militant. Well,
just tell them this. If you think your voting rights don't mean anything, when's the last time somebody broke in your house and left shit?
You're right. Why did it work so hard to take it away from us? You don't think it works shit. But they don't think it's important.
Amen. But John Lovio, my brother, glasses, my ride or die, man, how many years?
Man, more than I can count.
My ride or die.
We were together 23, we worked every shift, but we were out on the same sheet of music. We served together for 23.
Yeah.
23 or 24.
I mean, well, we got into some stuff, man, and I wasn't looking around for nothing but a blue uniform with a flash and a wagon wheel patch.
That's right.
So I knew I wasn't by myself. Because we worked with some folks that were scared to come up here. Now, Claire wasn't scared. Claire Crook wasn't scared.
No.
Mary Crook wasn't scared.
Yeah,
and there's two or three others. But for the most part, bro, when we walked off into those hoods, and my whole, when I look back over my career, and I'm trying to establish myself or be recognized, the community's going to give you an identity. It doesn't matter what you want to do, they're going to give you one. Fortunately, mine was favorable. But when I walked out there, man, I'm going to tell you, brother, you being with me, I was a hell of a lot more comfortable with you out there than I would have been a whole lot of officers who were black at that time. Because that wasn't good enough for me.
I never understood the fear of working that part of town. I never understood that.
No.
Like, there's people just like you and me. And that ain't got nothing to do with anything else. And if you accept the fact that, as we discussed at the start, only 10% of those people are doing nefarious things, and there's 90% over there that are looking for help, once you put it in that perspective, there's no reason for you to be worried about going over there. Hey, I'll tell you a quick story.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how I knew I succeeded in East Waco. One night, I was working midnight over there, and I got a foot chase. And I can't remember what we kicked it off. I think it was a gun, maybe. I'm pretty sure it was a gun. I chased this guy forever, and I'm finally caught him, right? It was one of those summer nights where it was 110 degrees. Here's how I knew I made it in that neighborhood. A 70-year-old woman came out of the front door of her house and brought me an ice-cold bottle of water.
See, you said, John, get out of my head, because I was going to ask you, you know, because it was like that really for me. You know, when you really know you're accepted is when you get in that Texas heat and you're working a murder and you're there with 5, 10 other officers, the media's there, everybody's there. Everybody's trying to look important. You standing over there with standing over a shell casing or nothing media savvy. And somebody from the hood comes up. Officer Mason, my auntie told me to give you this. You okay? Or my mom said you need. They're not asking everybody, not the news media. They're not asking the chief and the captains and lieutenants. They're asking you.
Right.
That is in the hood being real and 100 and respect. Respect, respect, respect. That is what matters.
Yep.
And it will save your life.
Hey, everything else takes care of itself.
That's right.
Yeah.
You can't save the world, but respect, and for those young officers listening that might not understand this right now, when you get to the point where you retire, all them people you work with are not going to blow your phone out. But when you occasionally get a Facebook message from somebody you put in jail for 20 years who wanted to reach out to you and say thank you, you were right, we let them call the show here. That's what's real. Be a change maker. Be a different. Blessed is the peacemaker. That's the point. And so with that, we're going to get ready to get out of here. Appreciate everybody. Love you all on Facebook.
I'll take care.
Everybody on Facebook, John, appreciate you, brother. Don't be no stranger. I'm going to be tapping your shoulder again because I know you always.
I got to ask you, John. Look at that picture
of
Stan Hansel, Disneyland, and that chick. That's it? Now, I can see you doing a crowd together. That would have been some hilarious shit. I would have been laughing. Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good time.
Oh, we had fun. Sean Pepper.
I had no idea that you retired. I mean, I only talked to you like a month ago. You were in the office. Yeah, I punched out. I've been retired at least about 3 weeks now. Yeah, I know.
Sean through you, and Sean's a real close friend of mine. You brought Safe Call Now to Waco PD. I'm going to give you your laurels. You're single-handedly responsible for that. Prior to that, our crisis management program existed. These are a bunch of officers' wives that you can tell your problems to. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I know her husband is sleeping with these three girls over here, okay? But no, that out the window. You brought it, and it took about 3 minutes. It's really, how did you stepped out there and did that, man? The department needed it, and you did it. Another feather in your cap.
I went to a breakout symposium in Dallas at IPA, which is the supervisor school that we're all sent to at Waco PD. I don't know if you would send your folks up there or not, or bring all people here for supervisor. So I was up at a follow-up by the other conference. It was a breakout symposium. They had a bunch of different topics there. Sean was a speaker. And I listened to his presentation, and I thought, man, Waco needs that. So I took Sean to dinner that night, and we sat down and discussed where he was going with his program and how he might be able to help Waco benefit from what his passion was. And so based on that and what we kind of worked out, I came back and talked to Ben Chief Holt, who's also a proponent of mental health. And we were able to run him through and that get everybody at the PD run through that program. And then from there, kind of finish out Waco's comprehensive care program for folks that were struggling. So that's how that came to be.
And what really got me was Sean, and I got to say this is a caveat. Midnight shifts, you know how we are, Jack. No bullshit. We're busy. We got calls holding. I'm going to have to go out here and work late calls and holding calls. Just get done with your little brief and let me get out. That's how we work. Going to Sean's brief. We had to go to it. It was mandatory. Okay. We walk in, and I'm thinking, okay, here's this vanilla guy up here. I'm going to have to sit here of a whole geopolitical explanation of mental health, and I'm not certified. Look, we got stuff holding. Let me get out the room. And when Sean started talking, I was immediately captivated because he had come. This was a police meeting. This was not open to the community. This was the foul language. So it is what it is. And that was me. I was like, I love this guy because he talked in language of what we see out there.
Right.
And after that, Sean and I were connected, and we talked about he told me about you, and he said, well, yeah, John Lomio told me you might be coming, you know. So when he met me, he kind of was already, he wasn't in shell shock, you know. But, brother, I appreciate you, man. Thank you for coming on the show today. And I know, you know, you didn't have to. And just the fact that I didn't have to beg you or ask you twice, you know, you've always been in my corner, man. And I appreciate that. Love you, brother.
Always. Forever and ever, man.
Appreciate
right,
it.
Hey, you need something. You know what my number is, right?
I got you. Joe, T?
My number's 911. Just give me a call. Hey, speaking of community and police, can you talk about my internet service over here?
Guys, Waco, Texas, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, ATL, Chewy, Texas, Chi-Town, Joe. What's that little town, Joe?
I'm not
going to
say.
Okay. Joe Bill. Oh, that's a new name, Joe Bill. All right, Joe Bill TV.
We got most.
Record. We're going to get out.
All right.
Later.
The recording has stopped.